Hi, everyone. My name's Kira. I'm an addict. Can we reopen this with the Serenity Prayer, please? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can. Yeah, I am from Washington. I am from the Icana area, the Interstate Crossroads area. So it took us a little while to get here today, but it's always an honor to be asked to speak, especially out of town like this, because a lot of times I don't feel like I have anything to offer or I have anything to share, and then God reminds me in different ways that that's not always true. So today I'll probably just talk a little bit, you know, I'll qualify a little bit at first, tell you what it was like to get clean and what it's like today. First and foremost, my clean date is May 26, 2007, so a couple of months ago we celebrated 8 years clean, which if you would have asked me a long time ago if I would have thought that I would have made it to 8 years clean or I would have made it to the age I am now, period, and not died, I would have said absolutely not. My upbringing was pretty standard. I grew up in a home with two loving parents, an older brother who, in my eyes, was absolutely perfect. He is 6 years older than me, so I was a surprise child. My parents weren't supposed to be able to have any more children, and then there I was. So my mother always invested a lot of time and effort into my brother. And since he was a lot older than me, I was not supervised as much, which was fine at first until I got into middle school. And that's when I started to get real curious about using and drinking. I was really influenced by what was going on around me. I never felt like I fit in school. I had a really, really, really hard time making friends. And even clean, it took me a long time to really develop close relationships in this process because I have a belief that I'm not good enough. And I've had that belief for as long as I can remember, that deep shame that tells me that I have nothing to offer anybody. So I would, you know, I was alone a lot. I was alone pretty much all the time because I didn't have friends. My mom worked two jobs. My dad worked night turns, so he slept all day, and my brother was a lot older. And so I was really influenced by what I saw on TV, what I read in books, and that sort of shaped my opinion about what it meant to, like, live a party lifestyle. It always looked very attractive to me. So at probably 11, my curiosity peaked, and I decided one Friday evening, well, it wasn't evening, it was like 2 or 3 in the afternoon, whatever time you get home from school, I decided that I was going to drink because I wanted to know what it was all about. And in my house, my parents never drank. I've actually never seen my father drink a sip of alcohol in his life, and I think I've seen my mom drink twice. So it's not like alcohol was big in my house, but they did keep numerous bottles of liquor in our pantry on the very, very top shelf. And, you know, I came home from school, and I took one of the kitchen chairs, and I climbed up on it because I'm very short, and I have always been very short, so there was no way I could reach it. And I grabbed a bottle of gin, and I got orange juice out of the refrigerator and in a glass, like one of those normal glasses, like this big, much gin thing, and that was my first blackout. So that pretty much sums up my entire addiction. Like, it was never about being social. It was always about escaping. Like, when I was using, I thought of it as being curious, or I thought of it as something that was, like, I don't know, for lack of a better word, like, the cool thing to do. And, further examination has shown me it's always been about escaping reality. So from there, I continued to drink the alcohol in the pantry by myself at least, like, once a week from 11 to, like, 12 or 13. And then when I got into high school is when I really started to use drugs. I quickly found the group of people that used in the way that I thought was attractive. When I found those people, I also found a subset of people that I really fit in with. Like, even though I had nothing in common with these people, I still felt accepted by them, almost because they had to hang out with me because I had the money. Like, I always had the stuff, so they were always around. But again, like, even, you know, the first time I smoked weed, I was with other people. But as soon as I started smoking weed regularly, it was by myself before school. It was by myself before church. It was in my bedroom, like, at night, hiding it from my parents. Like, it really wasn't, you know, as social. As time progressed, I started to use heavier and harder, and I figured out that, like, I could use certain shit, and it would make me feel a certain way, and it, like, suited my needs. So I had this, like, split life. Like, on one side, my mother was very, very religious, so, like, here I am going on church mission, trying to figure out into the car, into my bag, and nobody's going to see it, and are they going to hear the liquor bottles clanking? And then, you know, I'm in AP courses in 10th grade at school because I tested ahead of grade, and, like, I had this whole split identity. So I never knew who I was, and it was, like, a constant battle of trying to figure out where did I fit in, and I really didn't fit in anywhere. I didn't fit in completely with either side. But once I figured out that certain things helped me in certain parts of my life, that was a big turning point for me in my use. So I would use uppers to stay up for days and days and days on end so that I could get all my schoolwork done, so I could lose weight. Like, I was finally the social person that I could never be without them. And then I would use downers, obviously, to come down and, like, take a break is how I thought. Like, I would take a break. And this whole time I was, like, trying to juggle lying to my family and hiding it from my family, which we're all masters at that, and trying to, like, be a part of something. And, you know, I can remember the first time my mom found a pack of cigarettes in my bedroom. Being, you know, the ingenious addict that I was, I hid them in my underwear drawer like she was never going to find them there. And she put a sticky note on them that she left the pack in my underwear drawer, and she put a sticky note on, it was a pack of Marlboro Lights. I will literally never get this image out of my mind. She put a sticky note on them that just said, "Kira, do we need to talk about this?" Like, no, I'm not going to fucking talk to you about it. Like, and I never did, and we never talked about it. And, you know, she found bottles of Jägermeister, empty bottles of Jägermeister in my cheerleading bag. And I explained that away. She found empty pill casings in my garbage can, and I explained that away. And they always believed me because my parents live in this huge denial that that I would actually have a problem because I was raised better than that, or I came from a better family than that. I was smarter than that, whatever it might be. And I'll talk a little bit more about the whole family dynamic later. But, you know, when I was using, probably when I was in 11th grade is when Oxycontin started getting really popular. And a lot of the kids that I got high with started using pills. And, you know, I was one of those people that was like, well, as long as I don't use that, I'm better than them. I'm not as bad as them. You know how we do that. And so for a long time, I held out, and I convinced myself that uppers were what I liked, and I really just continued to use those until I met a guy. And, of course, it's always, you know, it's always a dude, and he had progressed from the pills to heroin. And, you know, part of my story is that I am somewhat codependent on other people, especially when I'm not using, because I'm really not healthy. And, you know, I got into this relationship, and this guy became everything. So since he was using something, I needed to be using it as well because, you know, when he would use that, took our time away or whatever I thought at the time. But all I know is that he was literally my life. He was the center of my universe. So the substances kind of went away for a little bit for me, and, like, he was my drug. So eventually I started using heroin with him, and, like, I got a full ride, a full scholarship to a really good university in Pittsburgh, full academic scholarship. Everything would have been paid for, and, you know, that's when I started using dope. And, like, before I knew it, like, used 3 days. Using every day, didn't really care. I worked in a cash office at Macy's. They were letting me handle money when I weighed like 82 pounds, soaking wet, had pick marks all over my face. I was a total disaster, and nobody in my life said anything about it. So nobody in my life ever, like, said to me, you know, Kira, what's going on with you? Like, why did you lose so much weight? Why did your attitude change? Nobody ever said a word. So that reinforced my feeling of not belonging, and, like, that reinforced that, like, nobody cared enough about me. So I didn't care at all about myself. Well, eventually, the guy that I was dating decided that he had had enough of my bullshit because I was crazy. I was totally crazy at that time, and, like, he had had enough of it, and he told me, even though, you know, like, he was probably shooting up as he said this to me. He told me that he was going to leave me if I didn't go get clean. And in my sick mind, I was like, that's a totally reasonable request. That's completely reasonable. And so that day, well, maybe we fought about it for a couple days or something, but it was right before winter break because I was in college and I was getting ready to take my finals. And, you know, I said that my parents are in total denial about my disease, and you know, they never quote unquote suspected anything, but I don't know how they couldn't have known. Like, all the signs were there. But I called my mother at work, told her that I was a heroin addict and I needed to go to rehab, and, like, I called a rehab and I went to rehab the day after Christmas. And I had no intention of really staying clean. Like, it was, I didn't understand this disease. I had briefly been introduced to this fellowship and this program by the guy that I had been dating. He had taken me to a couple meetings, but I was always, I know, because every time he would try to read to me from the literature while we were high, it made me so uncomfortable. And I couldn't identify at the time that was because it was, like, reaching that part of me that heals us when we get here. So I really thought that as long as I stopped using the heroin, that I'd be cool. Like, that's all I needed to go get help for. That was the problem. Like, I could still use a little bit of coke every once in a while, maybe just, you know, one weekend a month. I could drink, and I could definitely still smoke weed. Like, nobody was going to tell me any different. And I should mention I was 18 years old at the time, so one of my biggest hang-ups was my 21st birthday. Like, it's really big where I'm from that you do this bar crawl in the South Side on your 21st birthday. You just bar hop. And I was like, I'm doing that. That had been, like, a goal of mine since 14, and I wasn't going to give that up. So when I went to rehab and they told me that I had to be completely abstinent from all mood and mind-altering substances, I was like, absolutely not. But I was real quiet and reserved, so I didn't say anything to anybody. Like, I'm not the person who's going to be like, well, no, that's not going to work for me. I just got my first reservation. Like, my first reservation developed in rehab. The one thing about my process in rehab was that I heard an H&I speaker come in, and he's a gentleman who is still clean in my area, and he has been clean longer than I've been alive, and that blew my mind when he came in to speak, and he told me that he got clean the year that I was born. Like, that, I didn't even know something like that was possible. He came in, and he shared for H&I, and I was really intrigued by it, because I could relate to a lot of the stuff he was saying, even though there was so much difference. Like, and arrested, pulled over and searched by the cops a couple times, but I've never gone to jail. I have a lot of I've nevers. I have a lot of things in my story that make me believe that I'm different from the rest of you and that I don't need to be here, especially then. And even though his drug of choice was different, he was so much older than me, like, even though there were all those differences, he was talking about that feeling of emptiness, that feeling of never belonging, and I could relate to it. And it started to change my thinking a little bit. And that was really when I thought that maybe there was something to this program. Like, I started to buy in a little bit. So I did, you know, I did my 30-whatever days there because they kept me longer. My mom and my therapist conspired against me, so I couldn't go back to school. Because my mom's goal was to get me away from this guy because she thought that he was the root of all evil. Really, it was me, but in her mind, that was the problem. And my therapist knew that if I went back to college, like, there was no hope for me to stay clean. So they, you know, kept me out of school, so I had to withdraw, therefore lost the scholarship, and now I owe so much money in student loans, it's not even funny. But they suggested to me that I go to a three-quarter house, and I was absolutely against it. Because, again, I was still in a relationship, and I wanted to stay in that relationship. I thought that he and I were going to be that one couple that can get high together and get clean together and stay clean together. Like, I thought it was going to be like a fairy tale romance. And that was not the case, because meanwhile, I was having a rehab romance while in rehab, not telling him about it. And so when I got out of rehab, we were in the South Side, and I was getting a tattoo because I had saved a paycheck from the job that I somehow kept and got out of rehab and was like, I have to get a tattoo. That was the only option. And we were down there, and the rehab romance called my cell phone. And I, of course, because I'm an asshole, answer it. And I'm like, oh, I'm not with anybody. What are you doing? Like, I'm just, like, having a conversation. Like, he couldn't hear it. And that was the end. That was the end of our relationship. So once that relationship was gone, I had nothing left. Because that relationship was highly abusive on both ends. And I had become isolated from every single person I had ever known, including my family. And I couldn't stay in my parents' house. I couldn't. I knew I could not stay in my parents' house. And not even necessarily because I wanted to be clean, but just because there was something in me I knew I couldn't stay there. And I had my folder from the rehab, and that night after he broke up with me, I sat at my childhood bedroom window, chain smoking cigarettes out the screen, and just repeating the third step prayer over and over and over again, because I had no idea what else to do with myself. The next day, I called the rehab, got a number for a three-quarter house. The day after that, I moved into a three-quarter house. And, like, that is the first experience that I have with God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I didn't feel that at the time, but there's no way I would have ever gotten out of that relationship on my own. There's no way at 18 years old I would have had the balls to move an hour and a half away from home with no money, no job, no friends. But somehow I did it. And I also stood up to my mother about it, which she and I have a kind of dysfunctional relationship, so in a lot of ways, that was a pretty big deal. But, like, that's where my story really starts. And this is where I cry every single time. And I cry because I'm so grateful. I hate it when I cry. I'm so grateful for the woman that I'm. For the woman that took me in. One of the girls that came with me today was actually my roommate in that three-quarter house. And we were, like, the only ones still clean, but that's okay. But so I went to this three-quarter house, and, you know, I talked to this woman on the phone, and it sounded like she smoked 10 packs of cigarettes a day. I thought she was going to be like 85 years old. And then I meet her, and she has this like smoking hot body. She's gorgeous with that fucking voice. She had on like thigh-high boots. But so I went, you know, I went to this house, and she told me, like, here, you have to do a 90 and 90. You have to get a sponsor. You have to get a home group, and you have to get a job. Otherwise, you can't live here. And I have never had to take responsibility for anything in my life before that moment. And I don't know if anybody read the gist for today, but it was about taking responsibility for our life and our recovery. And it really made me think about Pam. And, you know, I tried to shirk all of that. I tried to get out of going to the meetings. I tried to get out of getting a sponsor, because all the while, like, in my mind, I didn't need to be in this program. Like, I was different than all of you. I had so many I've nevers. I was so young. How could I possibly know that I was an addict? And, like, when I went to these meetings, there was a solid 5 or 6 years age difference. Like, I was the youngest one in my area at the time, and it was that way for a little while. And, but somehow, like, through just living there, I started to kind of embrace the idea of doing that kind of stuff. Now, I'm not going to lie. Like, part of the reason I started going to meetings was because I found out I could meet a lot of dudes there. So that was appealing. But it got me there. Like, it got me into the room. And then, because I didn't want to get put on blackout at the three-quarter house, you know, I got a group in name only. Both were in name only. And I kind of held out that way for about 6 months, and then my brother got married, and I had to go to an out-of-town wedding. The sponsor that I had told me, like, take a meeting list, find the meetings in the area, drive yourself, you know, make sure that your family understands your boundaries. But what I didn't mention is that other than my mother and my father, nobody else, not my brother, like, nobody else in my family knows that I'm in recovery, because it's a big secret to my mother. And, like, at the time when I first got clean, I didn't realize how messed up that was. But now I feel like it's too, I don't know, it's real complicated now. But so it was like a big secret. So therefore, you know, nobody in my family knows I'm in recovery. Nobody in my family knows that I shouldn't be drinking at this wedding. So all night long, one after the other, like, they just kept offering me drinks. And, like, I was able to decline the first couple, and then finally when it was time for the toast, like, I took that champagne down, and then there were about 9 or 10 drinks after that because it was an open bar. And at the moment, I knew that what I was doing was wrong, but I still felt like I was different. And there was also another part of me that didn't want to give up the relationships that I had finally built with the fellowship. And so what that resulted in, because I thought that all of you were going to turn your back on me. Like, I thought all of you were going to leave me. I thought my sponsor wouldn't sponsor me. I thought I wasn't going to be welcome in the room. I didn't understand relapse that well. So I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell anybody that I had used. I convinced myself for a long time that it wasn't that big of a deal, because my problem was never alcohol. Even though in our readings it says alcohol is a drug, I thought I was different and special. So for about 9 months, I lied about my relapse. But then my guilt got to the point, because I was still going to meetings. I even during the steps, like, I was still technically working a program. I just had, like, this huge secret that I wasn't telling anybody. And finally, the guilt started getting to me. So I should have had over a year clean. And I did pick up key tags that I shouldn't have been picking up. And I did pick up a year key tag, but the guilt started to get so bad that, like, when we would go to meetings, oh, I probably shouldn't say that. When we would go to meetings, I would, like, sit there and look through my purse when they would do clean time and say, would anybody with a year or more please stand? Because I was like, well, if they think I'm distracted, they won't notice that I'm not standing. Because I couldn't stand and, like, lie to everybody in the room anymore. And then finally, one night, I just broke down. And I don't know what the catalyst was, but, you know, the next day I went to my home group, and my sponsor had the same home group as me at the time. It was a women's meeting, and I just started bawling my eyes out at the meeting. And it was like that ugly cry with, like, snot and all kinds of terrible stuff. So after that, I really started to feel like the hopelessness and the desperation that we talk about in this program. So after a little while, I knew I needed to recommit to working a good program, and I started working steps with my sponsor. I got a different home group, and I started going to it. And that lasted for a little while, but, it's really bad. But it's really raining. But then eventually, I still wasn't totally bought in to this process. So I started falling off again, and I started telling myself that I didn't need... You're okay. And I started telling myself that I didn't need to be here and I didn't need to work a program. So I decided I wasn't an addict anymore and I was done. And I had about a year and a half clean at that point in time. And I did not come to a meeting or talk. Well, I talked to one person in recovery. But I didn't talk to, like, a single soul in recovery for about 9 months to a year. And that was finally the experience that showed me how much I need to be here. Because with multiple years clean, I was more miserable, desperate, and hopeless than I ever was using. I really, like, by the time I decided to get some willingness again, like, I had two options. Like, I was either going to kill myself or I was going to come back to the rooms. And luckily I chose back to the rooms, but it was not, again, it was God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. So, like, a lot of suggestions were made to me. Like, I had to do a 90 and 90 again. I had to call my sponsor every day. And where I live, where I go to meetings, there are a whole lot more newcomers than there are people with time. So by the time I made it back into the room, I didn't know anybody. And like I said, I had one relationship that I kept, and, like, that was all I had, was that one relationship. And it was really a struggle for me to build new relationships. So I started going to this meeting on Sunday nights, and it, like, split into men's and women's. And I was still at the time holding on to the, like, I'm different. And there were these women at this meeting who would just not leave me alone. And they would call me, they would text me, like, they would invite me to other meetings and ask me to go out to eat. And, like, they all had less time than me, so I felt some kind of way about it, because I was like, I'm the one that should be doing this, but here they are, like, reaching out to me. I'm the new, like, I was the newcomer, but I just still couldn't see it. And, like, thank God for those women. And, like, if that would not have happened, I don't think that I would still be standing here. Because what I found out for myself, and this is just for me, like, a big part of what gives me daily fulfillment is the relationships, the meaningful relationships that I've developed with other people in this fellowship. Because nobody can understand me like the people in this room. Everybody else just thinks I'm real messed up, just real messed up. And I've been able to tell these women, like, my deepest, darkest secrets, things that I am so unbelievably ashamed of, and, like, they don't bat an eye. Like, they either don't say anything, or more often than not, they laugh at me. And I'm like, I don't know why they're laughing at me. And, you know, that is one amazing, amazing thing. That's one amazing reward that I have gotten from this fellowship. But, like, a lot of other stuff started to happen when I actually started to work this program. Because it was I had about 3 years clean before I actually started to embrace step work and embrace this process. And, you know, since that time, I have been able to accomplish a lot of physical things, like external things. Like, I was able to go back to college and get my degree. I now have, like, a pretty good career. But I have goals today. Like, I have goals that something better can happen. So today I'm just filled with a lot of gratitude because of what this fellowship has given me. And, like, most importantly, the internal work that I've been able to do in this process and the rewards inside that I have gained are what I'm most grateful for today. Like, I can look at myself in the mirror. When I got here, I had the self-esteem of a potato, so non-existent. There was none. And, like, today I'm all right with myself. I can also take responsibility for my life and my actions. Like, when we were on the way up here, I got a little snippy with two of the girls in my car because I hadn't smoked a cigarette in 2 hours. And, like, I was able to promptly make my amends. Even though I didn't want to internally, I really didn't, I was still able to. Like, I have that capability today. And that's a huge difference from when I came in here. But I think that that's all I have to share. And thanks for having me. Thank you.